You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht, Benjamin Pieske, and Sam Gartner, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today we are talking about the opportunities for data science in the pharmaceutical industry. A really hot topic, so stay tuned for this. There are already lots of different other episodes about data science, and we'll have a couple of more kind of methodological things coming up later this year about this area. So there's lots of other things you can learn about data science. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician. Today, I'm talking with Dacheng Liu from Boehringer Ingelheim. Hi, happy to have you on the podcast.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Very good. You work in an organization that very much emphasizes the use of data science and data science applications in the pharmaceutical industry. How did you get into this area of data science, and what does data science mean to you?
Thank you. It's a great question. It makes me reflect how I end up where I am now. So if I think, back in my college days, I studied mathematics in undergraduate when I was in China. And then after that, I actually spent a few years doing my master in the area of information system. Mm-hmm. So these two are kind of closely connected, the information system with what we call nowadays, information technology, data science, these are all connected. And mm-hmm. I remember, as part of the requirement to get my master degree, I had to study this thing called a data structure algorithm.
What is data structure algorithm? What does it mean?
Well, it basically, the types of data you would analyze, in a computer system, and then the typical algorithms such as sorting, those kind of things.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
You can have a tree structure in the computer system, and how do you do things based on that data structure? So there are various algorithms attached to it. In my case, I wrote a paper while doing my master. It's using the statistical methodology, a simple one, that mm-hmm. is to do the sorting. So I still remember it's basically about, when you encounter a large data set and the distribution is usually unknown, right? And then your sorting mm-hmm. algorithm will suffer. So you have to turn that unknown distribution into something uniform. So mm-hmm. essentially you apply this inverse function of your cumulative distribution to turn it into uniform, and then that makes things so much faster. Ah. And after that, I went to US to study statistics. Okay. You can see that connection, right? And then after I got my PhD in statistics, I did a postdoc in Rochester, University of Rochester, and that was mainly about the mathematical modeling of immune system. And after that, I joined Boehringer Ingelheim. Okay. So, and I always had a very strong interest, when I was doing my PhD in the area of computing, Bayesian computing and model selection in particular. So that was a very strong interest area for me. And all these things are really connected in terms of data science.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. So if you would give a definition of what data science is, what would that be?
Okay, I, this is a...
oh, maybe very, if you would say, Who is actually a data scientist? What's the job of a data scientist?
Okay. I think you may get many different answers from different people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to say that there are really two papers that really influenced me a lot in this area. One is the Leo Breiman's tool culture mm-hmm. paper. That's very well known. And then there's another paper by David Donahoe. He wrote a paper, Stanford professor. He wrote a paper, it's called 50 Years of Data Science. I tend to agree with the definition David Donahoe provided in the paper. He basically says data science is just a science learning from data, doing whatever you need to yeah. learn from data.
Yeah. Yeah.
People associate data science with big data, for example, with you know AI machine learning. But I think overall, there are just many aspects of data science.
Yeah, I think there's lots of different aspects in data science. You know, it starts with organizing your data, what is some people call data management, but not data management in the way we think about clinical trial data management, but a much kind of broader view right. on how you organize all your data in your company and govern it and things like this. And then all the ways to up to the point where you get really information out of it and communicate this information. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's very broad, as you said. You know, in Donald's paper, he also laid out various aspects. What you said about, you know, data manipulation, data exploration, visualizing the data, mm-hmm. right? Finding some patterns, and then you know, you try to build a model, try to compute with the data, and finally, once you have something available, then you have to be able to interpret the data, right?
Mm-hmm.
In drug development, as you know, that we constantly discuss the results with our clinical development team, physicians, etc. So there's just many, many aspects to this.
So if we have this very broad definition of data science and, you know, pretty much everything is a data science method, like kind of computing a mean, doing a t-test, all right. these kind of different things are basically data science methods. If you would look beyond kind of, let's say, the typical things that we do, like mixed models and logistic regression and linear models, things like this, what would be, you know, the more advanced typical data science methods that you see we are currently using?
I think it's really difficult to kind of isolate a method from the kind of question you try to answer.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's always question first, and then how you can address a question using the data at hand.
Mm-hmm.
Some data may be simple. You know, let's say you have some univariate data, it's pretty simple. Sometimes you have, you know, high dimensional, you know, multivariate data, which can be complex. And you mentioned some of the typical methods we use in let's say, in clinical research, right? Linear model, et cetera, logistic regression. So I think this goes back to, I mean, Leo Breiman's tool culture paper. In drug development, I think historically, especially in clinical development, we really care about inference, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you want to say, okay, treatment A is better than treatment B.
Yeah, yeah.
You have a p-value less than 0.05 in the phase 3 study, so your drug is going to be sent for submission and get approved, right? So it's more about inference. While you know, in Leo Breiman's paper, he mentioned this two ways of thinking things. One is around inference, the other is prediction. So generally speaking, in clinical trials, I think we do less of prediction, than inference. So once you get into the complexity of prediction, where you know you try to link all kinds of data sources, that's where you know more complex methods are used. I wouldn't say they're more complex. Sometimes they're just you know less familiar for statisticians with you know the traditional training in the inference framework.
So, it could be just, you know, a logistic regression where you have some kind of model selection and maybe some,
Yeah, right. You can turn logistic regression into a neural net and call it cross entropy, for example, right?
So prediction is one area, kind of prediction of, okay, people that will respond, people that, you know, will get a side effect, all kind of these different questions. How about more these approaches where you have lots of, you know, data and lots of, you know, endpoints, and you need to, you know, reduce the dimensionality. Where would you see as these kind of areas important? Where have you seen these more dimensional reduction problems be coming up?
Yeah, I think we can think of, so let's take one step back. So let's think about a typical clinical trial, right?
Yeah.
Phase two or phase three, usually what we collect the baseline, it's really typically, you know, demographic data, some baseline efficacy, some baseline values, and, you know, in conjunction with, you know, very strong entry criteria, right? If you think about our clinical trials, usually we apply, I don't know, a dozen, 20 entry criteria.
Yeah.
So the patient also tend to be rather homogeneous.
Yes.
Right? So in this rather homogeneous population, if you think about the feature space, right? When you want to apply machine learning or whatever, the feature space tend to be featureless.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've done the exercise. We try to do some disease modeling using our combined clinical trial database, just based on baseline and some efficacy at baseline. And then it's usually pretty challenging to create a model out of such data set that can be reasonably predictive. So that's hard. So which means really we have to augment the typical data with some feature-rich data set, right? So in some early phase trials, you actually measure a lot of things like biomarker. You know, sometimes we measure the genes. So we measure all kinds of things, which you have a kind of feature-rich data to work with, okay? However, when you have a richer feature-rich data set in early phase, the constraint is the amount of data you have, right?
Yeah, yes, you
think
have
about typical.
You have very few patients, but for these very few patients, you know quite a lot.
Right. Yeah. Think about your typical phase one dose finding study, right? You have a few cohorts, each cohort with 3, 5, 4, 5, 6 patients.
Yeah.
So you have a very small data set, yet it's feature rich.
Yeah.
In addition, the other challenge is, you know, with early phase trials, it tend to be short term, right? So you only, you know, follow patients for maybe a couple of months and that's it. And sometimes what you really care about is long-term endpoints. So there's a huge issue, I think, in terms of how do you utilize early phase data, and how do you really translate that into something that's predictive into the future. So you know, just going back to the question, you know, I think maybe one of the possibilities is somehow we have to augment the data with early phase data. So let's say we augment it with real world data. That might be one possibility. So
if you speak here about real world data, is that more kind of, for example, data that is collected through wearables or things like that?
I think that's part of the so-called real world data. If you look at the FDA's guidance document, that's considered real world data as well. What I was thinking about was along the line of, you know, the typical electronic health record, reimbursement data, those kind of data. I think now I think the benefit of these data is, you know, you can have a long-term follow-up, of certain patients. And in addition, nowadays, there's a possibility of integrating, let's say, lab data, where you can get something that's really comparable to a you know, actual clinical trial. In addition, you know, there's a huge volume, right? There's a lot of patients. However, there are also many issues with real world data.
Yes, it's really interesting for certain areas, for certain disease areas, the amount of data that you can capture increases dramatically. So if you think about, for example, diabetes, where you have ongoing blood glucose measurements, and so you basically have, you know, over a day you get thousands of measurements, and or you have maybe you have you're interested more in kind of movement and movement disorders, and you would measure these kind of things with variables, or you know, these kind of topics. It's
Yes, I think that's another aspect that you know what you're talking about is things related to digital endpoints, right? As you mentioned, this continuous glucose monitoring. You know, where you can actually measure the data on a continuous basis. So you actually get this kind of high frequency data, so to speak. And certainly you have missing data issues, yet the hope is by augmenting the frequency, somehow you can boost the signal, right? That's the hope. I think sometimes it depends on the kind of indication you study. In some indications, I think this high frequency measurement can be beneficial. Okay. In some situations where, you know, you also have to wait for a while to see any kind of benefits that's going to show up. I think, for example, in the area of atopic dermatitis, right? I think there are companies which are really measuring the nighttime scratching behavior of patients. You know, the patient gets itchy at night. Certainly, if you have a device that can really capture that, that's beneficial. It's much better than a PRO instrument where you ask a patient to recall how was your sleep 2 weeks ago.
Or questionnaires that you need to fill in every morning, things like that.
And there you have, you know, this variability issue, right, with the PRO, and you have the issue with what is your MCID, by the way? What is your clinically meaningful difference? So there are all kinds of subjectivity and variability attached to the typical, you know, PRO instruments. So, but if you can substitute that with something can be objectively measured, then that's much better.
That's really interesting. The other part is if I think about dermatology indications, it's kind of imaging data. If you can actually, instead of measuring, for example, psoriasis via a questionnaire, basically, that the physician fills in or the patient fills in, you could take pictures of the plaques. That would be also completely different. I'm sure there's other disease indications where, you know, measurement and imaging data is even more important and gets more and more used.
Yeah, I think so. I think if we, you know, look outside the healthcare environment, just look at generally speaking, in computer vision and machine learning in that space, I think we have seen, you know, really rapid development in the area of computer vision, right? In terms of imaging analysis, you know, we're doing so much better with our cell phone, with, you know, those portable devices. In terms of disease diagnosis, you know, there are papers, publications on major journals, and to show that, you know, a computer-based system actually can already meet or even beat experts' assessment. So I think that there's definitely a lot in that area. I mean, within my company, I mean, my group, was it last year, we had a company-wide competition by using baseline image of patients with, you know, this, you know, IPF, it's called idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. We actually try to use the image or the scan, MRI scan of those patients to predict the disease progression. So again, if we go back to what we discussed, we try to really augment the baseline data with something that's really feature rich.
I think that is really a interesting topic. You know, if you have these image data at baseline, that both in terms of predicting who will respond, as well as also narrowing down kind of what are real cases in terms of the diagnosis. In some areas, there's a lot of, you know, potential for misdiagnosis. And if you can, get rid of these patients that actually don't have the disease, but just looks a little bit like the disease, that surely improves quite a lot.
Right.
The efficacy,
Exactly. So imaging data, I mean, one major benefit is non-invasive, right? So let's say if we are studying NASH, right? The liver disease, then, you know, the typical way of doing that is you have to do biopsy, which is not really pleasant for anybody. So,
and quite intensive,
quite invasive, right? So if there's a way that you can somehow leverage the power of image, right, to create some kind of validated endpoint to substitute or to become even a surrogate of biopsy endpoint, that would be a major benefit to the patients.
Yeah. It would be a major benefit to research overall, because, you know, you can do things much faster. It's much easier from a safety perspective. You can,
Absolutely. Yeah. I think Pfizer has a group. I think they are doing some kind of study in that direction in NASH.
That's really interesting. What other areas are there where kind of these machine learning and more advanced technologies can help you to better make sense of the data?
I think there are a couple of things. One is, you know, as we said, there may be a scientific question we need to answer.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. The other thing is rather, you know, from the operational perspective, you know, we can introduce certain methods to improve the quality. We can introduce methods that can kind of automate things.
Mm-hmm.
There's another possibility. I think we've been talking about many around scientific endpoints, disease, those kind of topics. But if you think about even running clinical trials, right? Are there ways to improve patient recruitment, right?
Yeah.
That's one possibility. Is there a way that we can assess our entry criteria? So maybe based on the data, we can say, okay, this criteria we can relax. And, you know, we may not need all 20 or 30 or 40 inclusion criteria.
Yeah.
We can boil down to 20 or 15, so then we can broaden the patient basis. There was actually an article this year written by, I think, a Stanford group on Nature on this topic about how to assess entry criteria for oncology patient recruitment. And that's pretty interesting. Duti Roy in my group, and she talked about the AI cure, right?
How, I had her on the podcast.
Right.
That is cool.
Exactly. So AI cure is this company which, you know, essentially use a camera to see if a patient is truly swallowing the drug, and then based on that to assign some kind of compliance a score. So essentially, Duti and her team did was to build a model. So then, you know, based on the AI cure data, you can say, okay, if I look at the data from this patient from past 4 weeks or 3 weeks or 2 weeks, we see a trend that this patient may not be compliant, then maybe there's an opportunity to inform the physician or the site, then they can introduce intervention to help the patient with compliance. Right.
Yeah.
So that's about operational efficiency. Another thing I could think of is that, you know, coming to the, you know, data management, you know, biostat data management, as we said earlier, you know, we have this SDTM, right, stuff. as an insider, you know, it can be a little bit complicated, can be error prone. Sometimes we have quality issues. So I think there are also possibility, let's say, can we do something automatic? You know, maybe use natural language processing to automate this process and also reduce the error.
That is interesting. So you basically use natural language processing to, for example, look for similarities and things like this. Yeah. So
Correct.
kind of have, don't know, the US spelling and the English spelling, or, you know, some the kind of a typo somewhere, and all these kind of different things that
Right.
potentially you can, you know, sort out instead of in the past, where you can just say is equal to or is not equal to.
Right. You can even look up a sky and say, okay, can I have an NLP that helps the machine to understand the protocol? Somehow that can also help you with a lot of things downstream and try to make things more automatic. I mean,
Actually, natural language processing, I think, is a really big area. Because if you think about it, lots of the data that we have is text. Yeah.
Correct.
So if you think about what physicians write down in their notes, it's text. Yeah. Case reports. Yeah. And
Right.
AE data, there's a lot of
Yes.
text in there. And if you think about, let's say, real world data, yeah, and just about all the social media stuff and things like this, and you want to better understand potentially certain trends out there, yeah, whether there's some kind of, you know, is a drug name associated with something that happens on social media, then all these kind of different things become really, really interesting.
Yeah, that's right. So in I think in the safety space, certainly, as you said, right? Can you deploy a bot that can really help you to extract any safety signal of your drug? And in a typical clinical trial, right? If you think about the AE narratives that we have to manually prepare the AE narratives. It's many texts, right? I think that's also where NLP may play a role. And if we are talking about real world data, there's a very rich information in physician's notes, which unfortunately usually is not available to pharma. But I think given the richness of the information, I know that some of the companies they do NLP, they extract information from the unstructured nodes and convert it into some kind of structured field. And it's also pretty useful if you think about some of the challenges we face with real world data. So very simple example, in real world data you have this disease coding, right? The ICD-10 coding, but oftentimes that coding is incorrect. There's a research to show that the coding itself can be 40%, 50% incorrect, even for the term of diabetes. So we actually work with a group in Harvard. So they developed some methods to extract information out of NLP, using NLP out of physicians' notes. And then they actually had actual physician to review the information to provide the right coding. And then you can build a model, right? Once you have labeled data, you can build a model to have a better coding than ICD-10.
Interesting.
So even in my team, so we were running this clinical trial in the patients with borderline personality disorder, BOPD, which is also challenging for us if you just use ICD code. So we actually worked with a physician down in Mount Sinai. She did some case reviews for us, about 200, 300 cases, and she would label each case as highly likely BOPD or unlikely, on a scale from 1 to 5. And then our team actually built a model in conjunction with some of the labels in the real world data. To have some kind of screening tool. So then we can deploy the tool at the investigational site, and then we can provide recommendations to the physicians. And these are the possible BOPD patients. So I think there are a lot of things to explore in this space.
Absolutely. So there's a couple of areas that I'm sure we in the past were not really able to leverage, or maybe just in a descriptive way or in listings, that
right.
maybe in the future will be much, much more easier to tackle. Speaking about the future, what do you think are the kind of areas where, you know, will in the future can do much more because, you know, we have better data, and more advanced methodology to solve questions?
Okay.
I know we all don't have a crystal ball, but based on the trends that you currently see, what would be your kind of predictions, your gut feelings?
Okay, yes. I mean, if we go beyond clinical development, if you look at the drug discovery as a whole, then I think there has been a lot of movement in the area of drug discovery. We all know this DeepMind AlphaFold, right? That which can really predict the protein structure based on the sequence amino acid. So I think in that space, in the drug discovery space, AI is going to play really a more and more important role. Now, going into clinical drug development, I think at the moment we are still kind of constrained with the challenges I mentioned earlier, right? Mm. For some large studies, we don't necessarily have those feature-rich data. And B, for some early phase, studies, we have some feature-rich data, but then you have the data size too small. And there's another part, if you identify some signal, right? Let's say you have a first-in-class drug, in early phase, you have some signal out of some biomarkers, but then you need to validate it, right? So by validation, you have to run another study usually, that means. And we all know how expensive, how time-consuming it is to generate another piece of data.
So these
are really the challenges. Nevertheless, as we talked about, right, there are some new types of data, such as imaging data, multi-omics data, which is also high-dimensional. There could be sound data, which is high frequency. So these types of data, they do introduce new opportunities for us. So in the space of digital endpoint, I think we talked about it, I think there will definitely be opportunities in the area of digital endpoint. Just one recent example, I think Merck submitted their phase 3 program with, I think it's cough medication based on the measurement of sound or cough through a device that was submitted earlier this year. And I mentioned this nighttime scratching behavior for the atopic dermatitis indication. It's coming in a way. And also what we don't see often, not publicized enough, is really in the early phase space where these kind of data can help us to make decision, either to continue, which means substantial investment down the road, or to stop early, which I think is equally important.
Yeah. I think the biggest gains probably will be before phase 2, or maybe leading up to phase 2, and after phase 3. Because after phase 3, you have also, you can collect much more data in the field. You have, I'm pretty sure in the future we will have much more data collected by patients, when they actually take these medications. And that says some companies will use these data to help the patients, stay on treatment, optimize dose, manage side effects, whatsoever, all kind of different things. Even, maybe alert relatives in case of anything is happening. So I think there's a lot of things we can think about that will happen in the future in this space. Because think about what we are already measuring in terms of devices on our body. And I think that will only increase over the years. because there's a lot of symptoms or a lot of diseases we can avoid if we detect them early, or we can better treat them if we detect them early. And I'm pretty sure there will be, in a couple of years, don't know when, we'll probably have lots of monitors for typical things on our body, I would guess.
Yeah, I agree. Just think about, all the functionalities of your Apple Watch, right? So
All the cardiovascular topics. I'm pretty
yeah.
sure is very easy. There's lots of things that are rather easy to measure,
Yes,
which will be important.
absolutely. And just tack on what you just said about post-approval data collection, right? So if you have access to again, to real world data post approval, and there you also have the opportunity, as you said, to provide some kind of individualized treatment solution, right? If you think about in the space of diabetes, let's say your company has a luxury of having all the classes of drugs, and if the database is large enough, and then maybe you can even develop algorithm to say this kind of patient should follow this kind of treatment pattern. If you fail this one, then maybe the next one should be, out of the five classes, you should be class number three. You should do this, right?
I
I think,
think these high cost chronic diseases will probably be the first ones, and diabetes is very much at the forefront of that.
That's
I
right.
completely
Yes.
agree. Awesome. We touched on a lot of different things, starting from kind of what data science is, how we can describe it, and going into a couple of different examples and use cases of data science, up to where we might be in a couple of years or a couple of decades. And things that just tells us that we need to be on top of what's happening here, and there's a lot of opportunities for quantitative people like us to play a significant role here in this field. Any kind of key takeaways that you would like the listener to leave this episode with?
Okay, I think, really coming from the clinical development perspective, I think we will not get less data. The data will become more and more. And in terms of types of data, again, there will be more of a variety coming along the way. So certainly I see the importance for our profession as a trained statistician to really embrace all the changes. So it's not only about inference. There's has a lot to do with, prediction, modeling, automation. These are all relevant for us. So, yeah.
Completely agree. And as you said, there's a lot of areas beyond the purely medical data where we can play our role. Steve Pyke had that mentioned in an episode some time ago, that there's lots of opportunities for us there as well.
Right.
Thanks so much. That was awesome to have you.
Thank you.
And keep in touch.
All
And
right.
for the listener, you'll find the links that Dacheng mentioned in the show notes. So check out all the show notes on theeffectivestatistician.com.
Thank you for having me.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team, who helps with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com to find the show notes and learn more about this podcast to boost your career as a statistician in the health area. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.